Welcome to A Conversation with History. I'm Harry Kreisler of the Institute of International Studies. Our guest today is Michael Kinsley, who is a journalist writing a column for the Washington Post. He has been editor of the New Republic, Harper's, and the Washington Monthly. He was the founding editor of Slate and most recently editor of the editorial and opinion page of the LA Times. He was also co-host of Crossfire on CNN for several years, and he was a moderator on Firing Line. Michael, welcome to Berkeley.
Thanks, Harry.
Where were you born and raised?
I was born and raised in Detroit, Michigan.
And looking back, how do you think your parents shaped your thinking about the world?
Well, I guess the main thing they would say is how they failed to shape it, because they would have liked me to be a doctor. And they had two children, and neither my sister nor I ended up a doctor. My dad was a doctor, and they would say that was a big disappointment.
Was it a household where there was constant talk about public affairs?
Yes. Around the dinner table, you know, we watched TV at dinner, very vulgar thing to do, but, you know, we were watching the news.
And in school, in high school, say, did you have any mentors who pushed you in the direction of writing?
Well, no, I wasn't even on the high school paper. I was on the yearbook. But you know, I started to get interested in it. I went to a private school called Cranbrook in Michigan, where I grew up, which put a great emphasis at that time, and I believe still does, on writing. And you had to write from seventh grade on 1,000 words a week, which is more or less what I'm doing now. And that was pretty rough on an 11 or 12-year-old, and that was good training, and that probably gave me the bug.
And where did you do your undergraduate work?
At Harvard.
And there were you on the Crimson?
Yeah, yeah. So I was basically, that was what I did instead of undergraduate work.
I see.
There's a few college newspapers, you know, the Cal is one and the Crimson is one and the Michigan Daily is one that you know, are substitutes for college.
Mm-hmm. And what did you pretend to major in then?
Economics.
Economics, I see. And then at what point did you get the journalism bug?
Well, It was, I sort of had it, and then when I got to the Crimson, that was where it hit.
Mm-hmm. And in that experience, there were any stories that you were particularly proud of that you did that even today stand out in your mind?
Well, I wrote a piece that is not typical of my writing since I've grown up, but that caused a big fuss, which was my first taste of that particular kind of adrenaline, you know, which was I followed a bunch of Harvard professors around who during the protests over the invasion of Cambodia, and they came down to Washington and went to visit Henry Kissinger and were basically going to end the war by telling Henry Kissinger that unless he ended the war immediately, they wouldn't have lunch with him anymore. And I sort of captured the vanity of that enterprise. I mean, not with any art, just by recording it fly on the wall.
And what was the reaction to the story?
Well, they didn't end the war, and the story got a lot of pickup. Mm-hmm. And in fact, it was picked up by the Washington Monthly, which was then my first outlet as an adult.
Before we get you into your journalism, you actually went to law school though,
yeah.
At some point,
yeah.
Early, yeah. And tell us how that came about.
Well, you know, this was a part my parents, I guess. Law school is where you go if you don't like the sight of blood, basically. And I went, as I recall, and I could be fooling myself, with the idea that I wanted to be a journalist It's a very hard profession to break into. At that time, law was not a hard profession to break into, and it was basically as a safety net.
Mm-hmm. And looking back, what did you get out of that law school education? Anything that helped you later in your career?
Well, yeah. A lot of people, kids who are thinking of going to law school, say, I want to go to law school because it'll be good training for journalism or for something else. I say, and I think it's true, that that's not a good enough reason to go to law school. Go to law school if you think you might be a lawyer. Because once you get there, there are these centripetal forces that do I mean centripetal? I think I do, that suck you in. And most of the people who were in law school with me saying that became lawyers. Mm-hmm. But it does train. Economics and law are two subjects which it's really good for a journalist to have a certain understanding of. There was a British economist named Joan Robinson. I believe she is the one who said that the purpose of studying economics is so as not to be fooled by economists. And the same is true of the law.
And so what then was your first journalism work after the Crimson?
Well, I'm in law school. The Washington Monthly picked up this piece from the Crimson, and then I made contact with the editors and got them to assign me a couple of freelance pieces. And the editor who assigned it was a guy named Taylor Branch, who spent the next few decades writing one of the great biographies of our time, which is his biography of Martin Luther King.
Mm-hmm. But, and go ahead.
But at that time, he was just a scrappy journalist like the rest of us.
Mm-hmm. And your first real opportunity came via Martin Peretz in the New Republic. Tell us a little about that.
Well, Marty Peretz was an assistant professor at Harvard, and he was one of these charismatic professors who had cliques of people following him around. I was not one of them. I didn't want to have anything to do with this guy, Marty Peretz, but he gave a course my last year in McCarthyism, which was really interesting, and I went to the first lecture and I got sucked in, and I never became a part of his set, but when I read in the paper that he'd bought the New Republic, I got in touch with him and I said, I know just what you should do. And he said, yeah, write me a memo. But it led eventually to a job.
Mm-hmm. And what was that job?
Well, it had a nice title, managing editor.
Mm-hmm. And what was involved in that job, other than the nice title?
Well, it was essentially to run the front half of the New Republic, if anyone's familiar with it. The front half is politics and society and everything, and then the back half is the literary book reviews and cultural reviews. And I was more or less in charge of the front half, except that Marty was the editor-in-chief, and he could involve himself to the extent he wished.
Mm-hmm. And the New Republic really had a long, distinguished tradition as a journal of opinion in the United States.
Yes, it was founded sort of just before World War I. Walter Lippmann was its most famous, employee, writer, Edmund Wilson, and it was very influential in the 20s and the 30s and the 40s, and then it started to decline, and when Marty bought it in 1974, it wasn't very influential.
Mm-hmm. We'll pick up your career in a minute, but at this point I would like to ask you, you really started as a traditional writer and an editor. And what I'm curious about, a lot has changed, and we're going to talk about that in a minute, but in those days when you began, what did it take to do these jobs well in terms of skill and temperament?
Well, there are two bits of experience that I had that I thought were useful. One was I'd spent a summer in college working on the copy desk of a newspaper in Michigan called the Royal Oak Daily Tribune, and it was just ripping through copy. And my boss told me every word you cut saves the owner money, and that was a crude attitude, but that was very good experience in sharpening words. And then the other thing was I lived in England for a couple of years, and I got hooked on the British weeklies. The New Statesman at that time was the hot one, and The Spectator, which subsequently became the hot one, and Private Eye, which is a satire magazine, and their combination of analysis and attitude. And this is what I thought I wanted to do, and luckily I got the chance.
Mm-hmm. In one of the pieces that I read in preparation for this interview, you talk about genuine knowledge and intellectual honesty. And of course, they're always in your pieces is a real market analytic rigor. Talk a little about that, because we seem to be living in a time where some of those values and ways of doing journalists are in decline.
Well, it's nice of you to say that. I hope it's true. I think that law school and studying economics more than law even helps. You know, they make you think analytically. I mean, the whole point of economics is that more of this means less of that. You know, it's the study of scarcity. And that is what's missing from our politics in a nutshell. You know, it's a sense of the limits. And so it's good to have that bred into you. And then law forces you to think in for the mile is salami slicing. You know, you think this is the way it is, and then what if you change the example a little more, and that mode of thinking is really useful too.
In one of your pieces, and I'm going to quote you now, I like to quote my visitors.
And they don't object.
That's right. But it's always interesting to see if they say, you're talking about being a columnist and a pundit, and you say, if you're going to peddle opinions for a living, self-assurance is essential. If you don't have it, you need to bluff. People don't want to read a lot of, oh dear, this is so terribly complicated, I just can't make up my poor little mind. Many's the pundit who has retired on full disability after developing a tragic tendency to see both sides of the issue.
Well, that was a slight ripoff of Evelyn Waugh, who has a character in his first novel, The Decline and Fall, who has to retire as a minister when he develops doubts. You know, but and that was also not quite honest, I would have to say, of me, because I think that there are two styles of writing in a column and on TV, I guess, too, for pundits. One is the from high to low style, which is I am certain that this is the answer, and my friend Charles Krauthammer is the most distinguished practitioner of that today. George Will is probably the model, you know, and they both very effectively use this technique. They figure out where they stand, and I'm sure they go through some intellectual turmoil, but they don't let it show when they're through. This is the way it is, and I'm so sure that you, the reader, just get swept along. And I find that when I read Charles especially. Then there's the style which I think is mine and others, which is a bit head-scratching, and trying to bring the reader along, not by sweeping him in a tide of certainty, but by sort of conceding the points that the other side ought to get conceded, and sort of showing how you reason through to your conclusion.
Mm-hmm. Now, you have been very early both a writer and an editor. What is the synergy between those two roles? Did the fact that you were a writer make you a better editor?
I don't know about that. I think the opposite is true, that being an editor might make me a better writer. Mm-hmm. It's strange that they are two different career paths. And one of the things I like about little magazines where I've worked is that they're not. You know, you're a collection of people trying to reason through to look at the world and say something interesting and important about it. And, you know, you sit in the meeting and you might say, I'll write about that, or you might say, you write about that, or you might say, let's call Harry out at Berkeley and get him to write about that. Mm-hmm. You know, and it's all the same.
So at the New Republic, as an editor, you were really trying to identify trends, a sense of the mid to long term issues that needed to be reported on. Is that
fair? There's many ways you could describe it. That'd be one of them. It was a lot easier before the internet, you know, because you could spot a trend, and you only had to hope that it didn't start for a week. Now you know you have to be ahead of everybody.
Now, as being an editor, let's one other point about you've had some tempestuous relationships with your publisher or the editor in chief, say, The Republic at Harper's and so on. Without getting into any particulars, what I'm interested in is how is that productive in a way to the enterprise, and what are the real negatives there?
Well, it's all about arguments, and you know, some of these have been, arguments can be productive, and even if they get a little overheated sometimes. I mean, Crossfire is that in miniature, and I would defend Crossfire on that basis. At the New Republic, you know, people felt very strongly, and you know, if we had arguments, sometimes bitter arguments, it would have been better to avoid them if we didn't have them, but trying to avoid them would have been unproductive.
Now, as we walk you through your career, you've really looked at life from all sides, I guess I would say, in terms of the various media that you've worked with, and you left the New Republic to go to CNN. There were other jobs, but let's move to CNN. Although that might not be what comes sequentially, and I'm there you became the co-host, I guess you would call it, of Crossfire. What I'm curious about is what was different about that role, and was it hard for you to undertake it?
Well, no one forced me to do it, so I did it because it was a change, and because it was fun, and because it paid a lot better than New Republic, and so for all those low-minded reasons, and then for one high-minded reason, which is that, you know, the conversation of democracy is conducted on many levels, and to give up on the level of millions of people in order to concentrate on the level of 100,000 people didn't seem to me to be a good thing. And trying to shape your arguments so that you could make them in 10 seconds to people who are not thinking about politics all the time, mm-hmm. but are coming home from a day at work in some entirely different area, was good discipline.
Mm-hmm. And what were you frustrated by the dumbing down, or was it dumbing down?
Well, I don't... The dumbing down is sort of a vulgar way to put it, but yes, you had to simplify your arguments. But I didn't find that frustrating. I found frustrating the need to present everything as two sides and labeling one the left and one the right. And I also found frustrating the built-in need for no dialectical progress. You know, the last thing in the world they went on Crossfire was for someone to say, that's a good point, you know, and then maybe, you know, you could change the argument a bit and maybe reach a conclusion, make some progress. They didn't want any progress because that would eliminate one of the subjects that they needed.
Now, that's a telling point, and I'm curious, was that just an element in this particular show and the way it was formatted, or is what you're saying, are you helping us understand a problem with the television medium today as a conveyor of news and opinion?
Well, I would have to concede that Crossfire was probably the most extreme example. But yes, I think it is. It is a problem. I mean, on the one hand, on the other hand, there is among among politicians a huge tendency to deny that issues are actually represent a clash of material interests and a clash of analyses in which one is right and one is wrong. Mm-hmm. So,
I'm curious because this experience at CNN may be a place to do a little detour here and talk about the whole state of discourse in this country right now. I mean, you come out of a tradition, Harvard, undergraduate, law school, and so on, and the body of your work implicit is a community in which there are rules of civility, reason, discourse. I mean, it's the old liberal notion that we grew up on. What is the state of that discourse now, do you think?
Well, I'm not going to be able to help you too much here, Harry, because I'm not sure I buy the idea that it's in a terrible state, which is what is implied in your question. I do think there's not enough intellectual honesty in journalism and in politics, which means, you know, something more than telling the truth factually. It means giving honest arguments, what you really believe, being willing to test them, you know, and so on. But I don't know if that's any worse than before.
Mm-hmm. You actually, you're at, in a recent op-ed, you were talking about getting beyond the pretense of objectivity, and you were writing about the new ethical obligations that we might find in opinion journalism. You talk about intellectual honesty. And then you go on to say it, because it follows up on what you just said. You said, are you writing or saying what you really think? Have you tested it against the available counterarguments? Will you stand by an expressed principle in different situations when it leads to an unpleasing conclusion? Are you open to new evidence or an argument that might change your mind? Do you retain at least a tiny, healthy sliver of doubt about the arguments you choose to make? So you think that's still... We still are in an environment where that is possible.
Well, there isn't enough of it, but yeah, sure. I hope so. That's how I earn a living.
Okay. Let's move on now, because after CNN, I believe you were there 6 years, you really...
Only 6 years.
Yeah. More gray hairs than 6 years worth, maybe, after that experience. You went on and accepted a gig, more than a gig. You became the first editor of Slate, which was the first online magazine, I guess you would say, or magazine, as they were called then. And I want to talk about that experience, because you really put aside these different roles that you had played, which were... traditional in the print media and became traditional in television media and moved to the internet. I'd like to talk a little about that experience. Why did you do it? And then what did you learn?
Well, I did it probably for many reasons, but the simplest one was the same reason I went to Crossfire. It was something different. And I didn't accept the job offer. No one offered me a job. I wrote to several companies, and Microsoft was the one that expressed the most interest. And you know, this was the beginning of the first internet bubble in the mid 90s, and everyone was in a panic about the internet, and Microsoft was too, and so they just said, come on and let's start this and see what happens, and so I did.
And in that experience, I get the sense that it was really an exciting time, because you were making it up as you went along, and you were really dealing with a situation where you thought something, and then you were confronted with the reality of what technology could do.
Oh, yeah. If you look at some of the early memos I wrote, you know, sort of thinking out loud things to my bosses there or to the first people, colleagues I hired, you know, they started with the assumption that this was going to be something which once a week you went to the web and dialed up and then downloaded to a printer and printed out. And so, you know, by the time we launched, we were changing it once a day, except on weekends. And now, of course, it changes many times an hour. You know, so we were slow to pick up on that. And any number of other examples like that. You know, there are in print, there are conventions that have been established since Gutenberg, you know, the table of contents, or that you start on page one of a book and you read from left to right and then you turn the pages. All that was at one time undetermined. You know, there used to be scrolls. Well, we were at that point, and we still are to an amazing extent, in the scroll age of the internet. People still haven't figured out how to present information and analysis on the web, and the conventions of how you get from an article to another article are still in flux, and that's a lot of fun because 100 years from now they won't be.
What was most surprising for you when you confronted all this? I mean, you weren't a techie type, I gather, and what I've read and so on. So you must have really had to change your thinking about a lot of stuff, as you were saying one has to do if one is really thinking through an op-ed piece.
Well, I mean, I don't know. It's a little hard to recapture, but I don't know.
Okay, let me ask you now, what do you think the long-term implications of these technologies that you were first experimenting with, and now we've moved to an era where there are more and more blogs every day and so on, what is that doing? What is the consequences of that for public discourse and for opinion?
Well, or let's talk about opinion, especially opinion in newspapers and newspapers in general. At this moment, in 2006, I better say, because you're putting this in an archive for the future, the newspaper industry is having a meltdown. They're in a complete panic over the internet, as they were 10 years ago, wrongly. Now they're a little late. They should have started panicking maybe 2 or 3 years ago, because the younger, you know, people who are used to reading and getting their information on a screen, that group is now, the cutting edge of that group is maybe in its late 30s or early 40s. When I started at Slate, the big comment I always got was, great stuff, I just don't like reading on a computer. And you know, that is, I don't hear that anymore. Mm-hmm. And people say, great stuff, I don't feel like going out in the rain and getting this dripping wet piece of newsprint. I'm just going to go read it on my computer. So then the question is it only going to change the way that these words are delivered, or is it going to change the nature of the words? And I've always been sort of poo-pooing visionaries who say that this is all going to change everything in life as we know it. But I have come to change my mind to the extent that I think that the medium is going to change the message, and that the traditional newspaper column or article is going to evolve towards something which is, you know, it's not going to be a blog, but, you know, it's going to be harder to separate reporting from opinion, and it's going to be harder to have one authoritative voice as opposed to a community of voices. And that's a little vague because I don't really know how to spell what's going to happen in detail. But something like that, I think. And you know, that's going to be an adjustment for the newspapers.
A good example here to further this discussion is the Social Security debate that occurred last fall, where there was really, I found, a lot of useful argument and information on many of the blogs. And I recall that you actually at one point wrote an opinion piece about the Bush proposal, and I've seen where you've commented on the response that you got to that piece. So you were actually experiencing firsthand the complexity of this. Talk a little about that.
Well, that was a lot of fun and very interesting. I thought this was an issue in which not only was Bush wrong as a policy matter, but that as a matter of mathematics, this privatization could not do what it was supposed to do. And no one was making that point. And I wrote it I did what you usually do when you got a bee in your bonnet. I wrote it, and then I wrote it, and then I wrote it again. And you know, no one was not enough people were. I mean, I thought, you know, everyone should say, okay, Mike, you're right, let's drop it. And so I wrote it in as condensed a form as I could, and I put it on the web, and then I sent it to a bunch of leading blogs, and I said, please link to this and tell people, I want someone to tell me why I'm wrong, or I want them to admit that I'm right. And, you know, that was a little arrogant, but you know, I got a very interesting debate going. Mm-hmm. Didn't really move the ball in the end.
But originally, had you published it as a column?
Oh, yeah. I published it as a column in Slate. I'd written variations of this argument maybe half a dozen times over the years.
Mm-hmm. And what is there more that you can tell us about the quality of the discussion that was provoked on the Internet?
Well, you know, we don't have to get too starry-eyed. A lot of it was garbage, you know, most of it probably. But there were people who took it seriously and responded seriously. And they didn't change my mind, but you know, and I think I was prepared to change my mind, but you know, it did force me to think, and it forced them to think.
When you took on the role at Slate, I gather that you thought it would be a lot like editing the New Republic, and I believe at the time Esther Dyson had alerted you to the fact that being an editor on the Internet was more like being an intellectual bartender, I think was her term. Did she prove to be right?
You know, I had forgotten that. Yes, I would have to say, well, not right, but righter than I would have given her credit for at the time. You know, there's a lot of garbage, as I say, in these blogs and things, and I think that, and I hope certainly that there is a role for you know, people who do this sort of thing for a living, you know, like me, in the future. And it's not all just people talking to one another, because, well, an analogy I have made is that you go to a restaurant, you want your dinner cooked by the chef and not by the guy at the next table. And I think that people who participate in these community forums and blogs and all these sort of things, generally, they're very interested in having their voice heard. They're somewhat less interested in listening to the other people who want their voice heard. So there's a certain double standard there, too.
So there's really a kind of a conflict between what elites can offer out of this tradition of authoritative voices, columns, established newspapers, versus the potential for the blog and the Internet to turn into a kind of a mass phenomena where everybody's cooking, to use
well,
your metaphor.
Well, yeah, but it there's nothing wrong with everybody cooking. And, you know, it's basically a fantastic development, very for democracy, not just journalism. A.J. Liebling, the great press critic, his most famous line is, freedom of the press is for those who own one. And that was his great theme in his writings in the late 40s and early 50s of the last century, was that press lords had had control of the political debate. Well, you know, anyone who thinks they can do better than me can do it for virtually nothing. And many people are doing it, and there are some who are undoubtedly doing it better than me. So I mean, I'm glad that the sorting and sifting hasn't quite gotten efficient yet.
As if this work at Slate and really getting hands-on with the new technology and redefining magazines were not enough, your next role was to become the editor of the opinion page and editorial pages of the LA Times. Let's talk a little about that experience, because it didn't end well. Yeah. What were you trying to do?
Well, I was trying to be an editor, which is what I love to do, while living on the West Coast, because when I went out to Microsoft to start Slate, among other unexpected developments, I got married and was rooted in Seattle. And so that the LA Times editorial page is a great job. And so it was basically no more than that. But I do think that editorial pages are in a state of crisis for some of the reasons we've discussed, and then for the additional reason that, you know, a newspaper is a very odd product. It's no one cares if a dry cleaner has politics. You know, there's only two kinds of companies where you need to be thought to be free of political views. One is newspapers, and the other is television networks. And yet newspapers are the only companies that routinely publish their political views, and it's they're the ones who can be damaged by them. So I think as newspapers get more and more cost conscious, you know, they're going to look at their editorial pages and say, "What are we getting for this? There are no ads, you know, and we're not getting any money, and we're putting at risk the one thing we really need for our news side."
Now, what undertaking this task, what kind of diversity, if any, were you trying to bring to the paper in light of the way the world was changing?
Well, I had all sorts of ideas for experiments to try, and, you know, because my experience at Slate had been, you know, we tried all sorts of things, and if they didn't work out, it didn't matter. You know, you'd kill them after a few weeks. And it didn't work that way at the LA Times for various intramural reasons, and for one large reason, which anybody who has ever worked for a large organization should have known, and I didn't, which is that it's a lot easier to start something from scratch than to take an established organization and turn it around.
And is that because of the owners or the journalists or what?
Well, it's everything. It's certainly the owners. They get very nervous, you know, about change. The current employees are the ones who are doing it the way it's always been done, and feel threatened naturally when something's going to change. And, you know, you got to say the readers too. And the one thing I learned at Harper's, which is no matter how bad, in your opinion, a publication has gotten, the people who get it like it, you know. Mm-hmm.
I'm curious, you tried different kinds of technologies too. That is, the idea that people could actually work on opinion pages, opinion articles that had been already put out by the paper. Talk a little about that experiment, why it failed.
Well, that was I mean, it wasn't a very big deal, but it's sort of become my legacy, I guess. Credit should go to one of my colleagues, but since it may be blame, I'm not going to say who. The idea was wikis are websites which sort of anyone can go in and change. The Wikipedia is the great example. And I thought we would try that with an editorial. And it was a very simple idea. We had a little sub-site where you could go to the editorial and re-edit it and put in your own opinion. And you know, someone else could go in and re-edit that. And it sounds insane, you know, as does the Wikipedia when you first think of that you can go in and change. Anyone in the world can go in and change what an encyclopedia says about a subject. But in the Wikipedia, it seemed at the time to be working, although they've had problems since then. So we tried it, and for a couple of days it was great. It was in an editorial about topic A, the war in Iraq, and the LA Times editorial line had been very much opposed to it. And we put a very hard-hitting editorial up there. And, you know, we had some amazing things. People went in and rewrote it, take different points of view. Then some people who were experts on wikis, without consulting us or anything, went in and split it in two and had, you know, one a pro and one an anti. And that was a great idea, which we hadn't had, and we didn't need to have because someone had it for us. And that was going great. And then a website, there's a sort of a snarky website, wrote a snarky piece about it, and suddenly we were flooded with really horrible pornography and child pornography, really, and we had to take it down immediately.
Mm-hmm.
And our position now, I don't know what their position is. I'm sure their position now is we're never going to do this again, but our position when I was still there was going to be we leaped in first, now someone else can go second, and we'll come third or fourth.
Does the thought emerge as a result of what you're saying, that in a way this technology can work when the communities are self-defining, but if it's an entity where there are too many different communities, then you get a breakdown and people can exploit the technology for other purposes? Or?
It may be something like that, or just may be the very fact that the power lies not in communities, but really in individuals, you know, makes everybody at the mercy of the nuttiest person. And even the Wikipedia, which this was less than a year ago, was the shining example, has had problems and is pulling back and is starting to have these articles redacted and things. So,
In both the case of Slate and the LA Times, a problem emerged in a way in the bottom line, basically, whether these new efforts could become profitable, or whether the people who were the financiers felt it was worth doing. Talk a little about that. I mean, two different cases.
Well, I disagree with you. First of all, the LA Times opinion pages had zero revenue, mm-hmm. and still do. And my thought was, you know, if you made them exciting, you could get an ad for them. They weren't even looking for ads. And at Slate, from the very beginning, my standard of when we could say we've made it was going to be when we broke even. Because when you're breaking even, you're not dependent on anybody else or an owner. Like at the New Republic, Marty Peretz, still one of my closest friends. But he would agree that he tried very hard to make the New Republic self-sustaining, because that is liberating. And at Slate, it took 6 years or seven, but in fact, it is now self-supporting. Mm. And you know, many, many magazines, Vanity Fair, Sports Illustrated, took longer than that. So, and it was sold last year by Microsoft to the Washington Post for an amount that approximates what Microsoft put into it. So I think we pretty much made our point.
Mm-hmm. Now, maybe I was being unfairly mixing apples and oranges. Let's talk a little about the LA Times, in the sense that the discussion about what's happening to the LA Times seems to be seen as a struggle between traditional quality newspaper men and women versus the business side of the operation. Is that fair?
That's a very fair and accurate description of the basic tension at this moment at the Los Angeles Times. But actually, our problem on the editorial page was different from that. For the same amount of money, I could have done what I was trying to do, which they didn't like. You know, so it wasn't a question of money in my case, and in the case of my colleagues on the editorial page.
Mm-hmm. I'm curious what your thoughts are about the impact of the Iraq war on journalism, basically. The way the build-up to the war was reported, the whole debate about leaking the Judith Miller case and so on. Is this just a controversy that one would expect with the initiations of wars that subsequently fail and so on, or is some qualitative change going on with regard to the media and American administrations?
Well, the big change is one that isn't directly connected with the current controversy about leaks, which is this business about being embedded. You know, the reporters in Vietnam, reporters were allowed to roam free. And one of the lessons that the government and the military drew from that was that is not a good idea because they report things we don't want reported, and so that's awful. So then the first Gulf War came along, and they tried with some success, not total success, to ban reporters completely. But that drew some protest, and there were some failures. So then they came up with this great idea, from their point of view, of embedding, which is a wonderful term, both literal and metaphorically, because it engages the reporters in it, basically in a conspiracy with the government, and they don't see what they, even the greatest reporter, is at a huge disadvantage.
Do you think that the criticism that has come at the media will lead it to rethink, you know, the way it does reporting, or whether it accepts or rejects opportunities like embedding?
You know, this is a horrible way to think about every, that very idea, every war. But if there are more wars in our lifetime, each one will, if now people are so obsessed with the media, will have... You can predict several things. There will be a controversy about how the media cover it. There will be controversy about some medical syndrome, you know, that will emerge from it. And three or four other things that are just the way we go about conducting wars.
You yourself identified, I believe, as a moderate libertarian. I'm curious, is that correct? And then secondly, how has your philosophical perspective changed in the course of your career? Because you've really assumed very different roles here, a traditional writer, editor, a man really at the cutting edge of technology, and so on, a media star, if you will. Have you kept to those principles that you started with?
Well, like everybody, I think I've been true to my principles all my life. But I sort of would define myself politically as unreliably left of center. I mean, I'm sort of all over the lot, but if you average it out, I average out to sort of a mainstream liberal. And I think I've been reasonably true to that. But, you know, I tell younger writers, write that piece today because you might not have the guts to write it in 10 years or 20 years. And there's no question that, you know, there are pieces that I wrote in my 20s that I won't write in my 50s, not for any high-minded reason of change of ideology, but simply because I don't have the guts anymore.
Mm-hmm. What about this mix between passion and reason in this work that you do. Does that, you have to keep that tension going, I guess, right?
Well, I think you can have both.
Mm-hmm. And
But you know, there's, I would say that what there's a shortage of is reason, you know, and there's plenty of passion. So sure, you should have passion and reason, but what the world needs more of is reason.
Mm-hmm. And I'm curious. All your work, I think, is kind of a search for truth, however limited, you know, one's particular efforts at a particular time are in reaching that goal. Do you think the conditions are still there to do that for somebody like you just starting out?
Search for truth?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Well, I don't know that it's necessarily harder.
Yeah. So you're not, I'm just getting the sense that you really don't think that we're living in the worst of times necessarily, which is what one reads on many of the liberal blogs.
Yes, well, I think this war is a terrible mistake and really a terrible thing going on, and it's distressing that it occupies this country so little. You know, it's now been 3 years. We're getting to a Vietnam-type length. You know, I thought it was very silly when people started saying quagmire, you know, 2 days after the invasion started. But, you know, it's 3 years now, and the numbers of Americans dying is, and it's all reaching Vietnam-type levels, and that is really... that is distressing.
And why do you think that there has been such a delayed reaction to the war? Is it what accounts for that?
Well, you know, many people say it's the lack of a draft. I'm not for the draft for reasons, you know, I can't get into. But it is true that we are able as a society to go about our business, you know, as if it wasn't going on. And the president has encouraged us to do that, you know. And I think that's a bad thing.
Mm-hmm. If students were to watch this tape, what advice would you give them for preparing for a future where they might see themselves pursuing a career like yours?
Take Ec 1.
Economics.
Yes, take basic economics. And that's what I've told every intern that's come through every publication I've ever worked for, and almost none of them have done it, and many of them have gone on to very successful careers anyway. So, but I still say it, that basic economics is probably the best thing, is the best training for a career in at least the type of journalism I do.
But no recommendation for a law degree?
I think I said before, you have to be honest with yourself. A law degree has been useful, not the degree hasn't been, but the study of law has been useful to me, but not useful enough to justify the 3 years it took and the money.
I'm curious, looking back at your very diverse career, what in your mind stands out as something that you're most proud of?
Well, I guess it would be Slate, you know, because that was really, I got to start it from scratch, and that was certainly the thing I feel luckiest about, the opportunity to start a publication, which is what every journalist, you know, longs to do, or practically every journalist, and to do it in a new medium, and to sort of be participating in the invention of that medium, although I don't want to claim that Slate was in the forefront of any technology in particular, because we weren't. But exploiting the technology, that was really exciting, and it's still exciting.
Michael, on that note, I want to thank you for taking the time to be here today and talk about your life and the ideas that have mattered to you.
Oh, thanks, Harry.
Thank you.
It wasn't a strain.
Very good. And thank you very much for joining us for this conversation with history.